It's so delightful. I'm always curious. Someone like Johannes Brahms wrote a big sort of symphony that he called a piano concerto. He was sort of working on a symphony. You've written this incredible work for two pianos called a symphony when there are these great cadenzas. Was there something about the name that you really wanted it to be a symphony with two pianos and orchestra?
You know, it's funny. It all was more of an evolution. I started off with no name at all, and I didn't even know when I first began the piece that it was going to be in three movements, that there would be cadenzas. It was really a real evolution where I just started with the opening theme for the first movement, and it was really started there, and little by little I started evolving, the piece started evolving for me, and then I started realizing, hey, you know what? I think I'm writing a symphony. but there was no two pianos at the time, but I had one piano in the part. And little by little, the piano started to become more and more important. And as I went on expressing the thematic ideas, I couldn't express it all with one piano, and I started hearing two piano parts. I was sort of hearing four hands coming in here and there. And I started thinking, well, how am I going to get, you know, one player to play all these lines? And over time, I realized there were going to be two pianos. But at the same time, it didn't start off as a piano concerto. So I didn't start off with the ideas that this was going to be this super involved virtuoso piano piece that was going to have the orchestra as a support system for the piano. It was really one of those things where it was a symphony and the orchestra played an important role and they were playing the challenging parts. But then the piano started to match up and become important, much more important than, let's say, the treatment of an orchestral pianist where they would come in and play more color. This was more of, oh, it's almost a piano concerto, but it isn't quite a piano concerto. So over the time, I started thinking, what is this piece really? And I started realizing, well, it is a symphony, and two pianos are playing prominent roles. So I think I'll call it Symphony for Orchestra and Two Pianos. And I figured that if I got the two pianos into the title, it sort of tells you that they're playing more than just a orchestral piano role. They're an important role, but so is the orchestra. So that's how it evolved. And the two cadenzas, by the way, came much later. I had written the three movements, and after I completed it, I started to think to myself, it would really be nice to have a few moments where I set up the movements, allowing the two pianists to shine and give them a starring role at some point in the piece. So it became important to me to develop a cadenza leading into the second movement and another cadenza leading into the third. And now I felt like it kind of tied even the title together even more. So I gave the two pianists their moment on stage. I also, you know, thinking as a composer, you know, in terms of getting performances, I thought, well, who, you know, what piano team is going to want to do this if they never get to be the star for even a moment? So I had to think of that as well. But it all. So you could see it was an evolution.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. I got to give a little incentive to the Naughton sisters or the Lebec sisters, you know, to do this work.
So, I know.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I was curious because you conduct your own works, that by the time you get on the podium, are there changes as things go along, or by that point, has it already gone through, you know, the great samplings and whatnot? Are there points, as you mentioned here, of, you know, sort of like, oh yeah, I'm going to add some cadenzas and make this a little bit, you know, and work into this larger form. Are there moments along the way that when you're on the podium, you're like, oh, you know what? Or is it something that, oh, next time I'll just, you know, I won't write the viola solo with trumpets in there or something? are there points where you're like, oh yeah, you know, maybe I need to change this a little bit, since you are the conductor?
Absolutely. I, you know, if I had all the time in the world while I was recording this piece, I might have rebalanced some things and emphasized other things. And even after it was all done, I went back into the score and made some adjustments, added some trumpet lines to support the piano lines that I realized I wanted it to be more prominent on the next go around, or the next recording, or when it gets performed for the first time. These are lines that didn't come out as well as I wanted, so I actually jumped back in after this recording, added some orchestration to the piece, you know, mild amounts, but just enough to get the next one balanced better than the first go round. So I was as a conductor, you know, you kind of, as a composer, I'm in composition mode, and then as soon as I had a date for when we were going to record this, I went from composition mode to shifting into interpreter mode. And it's a very different mode of thinking for me, at least. I kind of make a shift, although the composer in me never leaves, but it becomes all about, okay, I've got a very short amount of time to get this recorded. I'm on a shoestring budget. I've got to get in there and get out of there, and I've got to know this piece backwards and forwards going in there. So I made an extra effort to sort of pre-interpret, if that makes any sense. I had already interpreted it in my mind, conducting through the score over and over, and I tried to anticipate all the questions that would come flying at me. And because I knew, oh, when I get here, I know the trumpet player is going to say, you know, how am I supposed to play this? Do you want me to play this? Do you really want this on a B-flat trumpet, or do you want me to play this on a D trumpet? It's kind of high up there. I knew I'd get questions like that. And so I kind of had my answers ready, and that helped. And funny enough, those questions did come. I kind of, you know, I kind of knew where the musicians would say, hey, you know, how am I supposed to do this? And you know, and you get up there on the podium and you start conducting, and the recording is going, and it's interesting because for me at least, the balances were not there right away. I wasn't hearing all those inner viola lines that I like to hear chop through. I had all of these staccato lines that in the third movement where they were playing these fast 32nd notes and so forth, and playing it with kind of a near the bridge where it's supposed to cut through. And here I was conducting, I didn't hear it. But luckily it was actually on the recording. We just had to push that close mic up a little bit. But of course, if I had time, I could have spent more time balancing it in the room and we wouldn't have to push those close mics. So yeah, that's a long answer to a short question, but yeah, I definitely find myself rebalancing right on the podium, calling out changes as need be, things like that. I guess that's the advantage of being the composer. You can make changes and not feel like you're hurting the composer's feelings by doing that.
Yeah, and well, I just wondered because it's not the same skill set as composition, conducting, and the idea of the studios being charging and all this sort of stuff. So I just wondered, yeah, if there were things that you know had come along or do come along, you know, that being having that perfect position there in front of the orchestra to hear how things come out. So
yeah, I might have an opportunity to. I think it's going to happen in February of 2020 to perform this piece in Prague as part of a festival. And I have already, as soon as I got that phone call, I already started thinking about all the things that I'm going to try to get done in this recording, or hopefully we can record the performance, or you know, at least you know. But now I'm sort of going, okay, now this time around, I'm going to ask for this right away and get those violas to come out. And now I know how to rebalance the brass to make them punch in these lines, and you know what I mean. It's kind of that. Second chance. I'm hoping for that second chance as well. And then I'm sure after I get a second, if let's say the second chance happens, I'm sure I'm going to be praying for a third chance. I know there's going to be something that I'm going to miss out on the second go around and try to get. There's always something.
Oh, yeah. Cliff Eidelman's my guest, and a lovely new release on eNotes. Also has a chamber work called A Night in the Gallery that is just lovely. And I sort of chuckled to myself as it seemed to me like almost one of those memes on Facebook that says, okay, reach to your nearest book, take a blank manuscript paper, and write. No. But, I saw that, and it was so lovely that there's this story that, you know, you'd been traveling and then happened to see this book on your shelf. And so it's just, to me, a lovely bit of inspiration. How is it to put this together? Because this is a lovely orchestration and a smaller orchestra.
Yeah. The Symphony for Orchestra and Two Pianos, I should mention, was performed by the London Symphony Orchestra. And we did that at Abbey Road. So you could just imagine, I sort of had the best of everything. And for Night in the Gallery, that was a reduced London Symphony Orchestra. And when you reduce that orchestra to less than 50 players, they like to be called members of the London Symphony Orchestra. And so this is a chamber piece for 22 players. And it was a situation where I had gone on a trip with my family to Paris back in 2012, and we, being that the kids were pretty young, we didn't have much time with them. So I had to sort of rush through all the galleries as quickly as possible. I would have wanted to spend hours and hours, but I had to rush through, and so I didn't get enough of it. And when I got home, I looked up on my bookshelf, and there was this book sitting there called Treasures of the Louvre, and which had some of those great paintings that I wanted to stare at longer when I was actually there. And so I just opened the book, put it up on my piano, and started looking at some of the paintings. And little by little, this piece started to come to mind, and I started to imagine the characters that were on those paintings jumping right off the canvases and into life in music. And so I went no less than Rembrandt and others, Watteau and Boucher and other great painters, and I started to look at some of their great paintings. And music started to come to life. So I sort of pretended in my own mind that these characters all started to interact with one another on a stage. So I would love it for it to be sort of a ballet one day, because then they could take the characters from these paintings and bring them to life in movement and dance and things like that. So I think it could live there as well. But the paintings that inspired me initially were Rembrandt's Bathsheba bathing, and Watteau, a painting called Pierrot. I think it was formerly called Gilles. It's an actor or a clown image of this character just looking out, and I found so much depth in the expression on the face of that character that all this emotion just started flooding over me into a composition, and that really was sort of the spark, I think, that kind of got this whole thing. And I think that was the engine that got it all running, and then all the other themes started evolving from there.
Wow. Well, it's delightful. Folks can learn more at cliffeidelman.com. There are notes about the pieces and scores, which is just absolutely lovely. I guess I'd end asking, I know Korngold and Waxman and those guys, came from Europe and ended up in L.A. and wrote film scores, but they were so involved in concert scores. And there's some lovely pieces, whether it's for piano or orchestra, even some film concert suites. How is it to balance sort of writing for cinema and writing for the concert stage?
Well, it is, for me, since I started writing film scores, it's been something that I've kind of ping-ponged back and forth with. And since I'm a very visual composer, I would say. I sort of thrive in emotional stories and a painting and creating a story in my own mind about a painting. And it's the same thing with a film score, where instead of me generating some of those visual thoughts in my own mind and creating concert pieces, it's there for me, and then I would create music for cinema that way. But I've always been drawn to telling stories and writing from the heart and writing music that is emotional and means something to me. And so for me, concert music also is something that I have to do. I've always had to do it. It's something where I don't have to, where I'm the collaborator, and I get a chance to kind of express the music with just how I see it, and it also refreshes. It has always refreshed me to go back into the collaborative world of film music, where you have this group of people. You have a director to work with and producers, and there's the studio and there's the writer and all the people that you work with, mainly being the director, which becomes you have to create this music and show them and then they may have comments, and then you come back with different ideas and it's a back and forth. And so concert music has always refreshed me to go back and enjoy the collaboration. It's almost like, you know, it's nice. It's like a breather, and then you go back in and you're ready again. And then you get that breather, you go back out and write just music for its own sake and supported by only its own structures and its own world. And then I'm refreshed to go back into the collaborative world of film music. But it's funny. I find music is music, and whether it's for film or the concert hall, they have different functions. But it's still, to me, it's sitting down ultimately and coming up with themes and figuring out how I'm going to develop it. So in many ways, it's the same process for me. But obviously a different world.
Yeah. Well, congratulations. This is absolutely lovely. It's available, Enotes Music, and there's more at cliffeidelman.com. It's so lovely to talk to you, Maestro. Appreciate your time today.
Thank you so much for having me giving me a chance to share this album with everybody. Thank you so much.